are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, March 5th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks on the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartlands of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Daniel Bessner, the end of forever war and the end of the dollar's dominance. What does the International Currency Reserve have to do with U.S. hegemony and reducing U.S. empire with Daniel Bessner? Bernie Sanders' campaign hatches a comeback plan. They are flush with cash, getting ready to head to the industrial Midwest and talk about President Obama's praise of Sanders, even as he has worked to destroy the Sanders movement behind the scenes. Joe Biden's commitment to cutting Medicare, Social Security, and voting for every single trade deal that has ever decimated the industrial Midwest. The Biden coalition emerges, and it was always there for everybody to see if they were looking for it. Talk about that more later. Warren is out. Exit polls indicate Medicare for all desired by most. Why did voters in Texas have to wait as much as 6 hours in line? The Dow takes off and healthcare stocks soar after the Biden wins. Kind of tells you everything you need to know, folks.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. Democrats increasing the lead in Senate pickup opportunities. The ICC authorizes an investigation into possible war crimes in Afghanistan, which include allegations against U.S., Taliban, and Afghan U.S.-backed troops. Turkey and Russian, the Erdogan and Putin are set to meet as the next phase of the Syria crisis intensifies. All Brazilian opposition parties have finally come together to take on Jair Bolsonaro as President Lula gets person of honorary citizenship in Paris, France, and meets leaders across Europe, including on the right, Nicolas Sarkozy, who criticized the corrupt prosecution of Lula. And abortion rights had a surprisingly hopeful day at the Supreme Court. The House greenlights $8.3 billion for the coronavirus, even as LA County apparently is in a state of emergency. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Folks, it's a two-person race for the Democratic primary. We have a choice between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. I'm not going to, I understand feelings are very high right now across the board. I do think feelings and, you know, personal energy needs to be subordinate to a existential election and the bigger questions surrounding it. So I'm going to give you my analysis across the board, including things, that the Sanders campaign has done that I think are mistakes. But I do know this, that this is actually incredibly close. This is a marginal delegate count difference. The most significant state on Super Tuesday, by far, was California. Bernie won that by a significant margin. And this still will be the enduring story of this election. Incredible organizing in the Hispanic community. Not brokered through elites, not by certain discourses and signaling and this and that, but by grassroots, serious, deep, respectful, bottom-up, centered organizing.
He lost to Hillary last time.
He lost to Hillary last time in California. So We move into the industrial Midwest. Joe Biden is definitely more popular than Hillary Clinton. I think a lot of folks, and I've tried to say this for a long time, and I will take, look, an unpleasant noting of what I've said for a long time. Joe Biden's pretty popular. He's pretty popular across a broad swath of voters. Now, we would like to think that because he was an architect of the prison industrial complex, because he was an ardent advocate of war, because he's probably made you much more likely to be drowning in medical and credit card debt, that that would do the job, but it has not. So we need to be very strategic and very clear in the coming weeks about how to deal with Joe Biden, including the fact that, yes, he is a very weak general election candidate against an increasingly commanding president in terms of poll numbers. I think that this clip from 2016, and I want to just get back to the very basic things of the Sanders campaign. We've gotten way too obsessed with the mistakes they made in 2016. Sanders did a lot of things right in 2016. And a much more, and this is going to become less of a punchline, frankly, a much more awake and clear-speaking Joe Biden recognized that in 2016.
You know, if Bernie Sanders never said he was a Democratic Socialist, based on what he's saying, people wouldn't be calling him a Democratic Socialist. That's how he characterizes himself in sort of European terms, the Democratic Socialist parties in Europe.
But why is she having trouble?
Well, I think that Bernie is speaking to a yearning that is deep and real, and he has credibility on it. And that is the absolute enormous concentration of wealth in a small group of people, with the middle class now being able to be shown being left out. There used to be a basic bargain. If you contributed to the profitability of an enterprise, you got to share in the profit. That's been broken. Productivity's up. Wages are
stagnant. But Hillary's talking about that as
well. Well, it's relatively new for Hillary to talk about that. Hillary's focus has been on other things up to now, and that's been Bernie's. No one questions Bernie's authenticity on those issues.
And they question hers, you say?
Well, I think they question everybody's who hasn't been talking about it all along. But I think she's come forward with some really, really thoughtful approaches to deal with the issue. But I just think, and look, you know, everybody, you know, it's the old thing. No one, everybody wants to be the favorite. No one wants to be the prohibitive favorite. Mm-hmm. And so it's an awful high bar for her to meet.
So three really quick things, and then please jump in, guys. One, it's stunning, the disparity between Joe Biden 2016 and Joe Biden 2020 as a speaker and in his cognitive capacity. Two, he's 100% right about what Bernie identifies in terms of the core defining crisis of our time. Especially, look, if your primary concern is poor and working people, and that is my primary concern. I think actually that's quite clarifying. There's a huge amount of issues that are profoundly powerful and important, and they overlap and they have interconnection. But at the end of the day, that is my primary concern. Three, Joe Biden is now vehemently fighting against the solutions to the crises that Bernie's talking about. And at the flip side, there's another deep yearning in the country right now, and it's clear in the Democratic electorate, which is, sorry, to, you know, and it's, look, this is what the folks on my part of the left need to get very real about. But also, it's not the woke posture stuff. It is the Whole Food moms and an anti-Trump base. Biden builds could boost Democrats in November. Now, I think there's question marks around that, but that is the 2018 electorate. That is a broad set of people that don't like Donald Trump and don't want just sort of, you know, an obscene mess on television every day. I think that the Bernie Sanders campaign, tactically and strategically, in this very specific regard, has to figure out a way in the coming weeks to thread and actually connect those two critiques. We are going to be decent in the White House relative to Trump. Now, again, you know, that Doesn't mean we're not going to campaign. Doesn't mean we're not going to critique other candidates, you know, so don't misinterpret what I'm saying. But there isn't going to be what repulses you about Trump is going to be taken care of no matter what the media says. And that's going to be a hard push. And part of the context for all of this stuff that you don't like in this country right now that is exemplified by Trump is because of all these other problems that Joe Biden is not going to do a damn thing about. And they might not be of immediate concern to you, as you know, suburban affluent voters say, but they connect and are inescapable from what you don't like. It's a tough task, but it's doable. Bernie has no one has more credibility than him on it. But we need to, and also as supporters, folks need to think very, very tactically. We've been way too indulgent of certain arguments outside of the Sanders framework, Sanders campaign, and way too dismissive and not cognizant of others. Do you guys have anything you want to jump in on that?
Nothing particularly, only that it's a shame he didn't actually run for president in 2016 because he would have been much better than Hillary.
If Joe Biden ran for president in 2016, he would be running for re-election right now. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I think Bernie absolutely would have. I think he definitely would have beat Trump in 2016, but Joe Biden would be president right now.
And frankly, like that's a piece of information that low information voters think, right? Like that he would have won in 2016. And I think that's frankly as much. I mean, the Obama thing is also big too, but there's a lot of people who thought like I would have voted for Biden, but I left it blank because of Hillary.
100%.
And I think that's
100%.
It's tough.
Absolutely. Is everything all right, guys? You know that Honey is the free online shopping tool that automatically finds the best promo codes and applies them to your cart. And you know how great it feels to save money. Well, saving with Honey feels even better than great. It's like boarding a plane and realizing you have an entire row to yourself. I actually had that last night. It does feel great. Or like finishing up your podcast episode right as you walk into work. Honey has found its over 18 million members over $2 billion in savings. That's a lot of money. Plus, Honey supports over 30,000 stores online, including Macy's, Target, Sephora, Best Buy, and more. And they're adding more stores every day. You know users love Honey since it has over 100,000 five-star reviews on Google Chrome Store. I started using Honey because I have very little patience. Shock of all shocks. And I would just, you know, if I needed to, and I'm not, you know, I don't do a huge amount of shopping online, but if I needed to do something or, you know, book a flight, whatever, buy something, get a book, get, you know, order, something online, I would just be like, I don't have time to figure out how to get this code, right? And then, you know, I started to realize this is really stupid. I'm losing here. But at the same time, I don't want to spend all day putting in different random Google searches and whatever. I got Honey, boom, it's right there. Now I know it. I get all the savings. Using Honey feels pretty great. Think of it as a little daily victory. Plus, it's free to use and install in just a few seconds. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's join Honey, like honey, H-O-N-E-N. That's joinhoney.com/majority. Another supporter of today's show is Skillshare. The Majority Report is made possible in part by Skillshare. And the first 500 people who go to S, as in Sam, K, as in Killmonger, L as in loser.
Did you forget an I?
No, it's skl.sh.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, sorry.
skl.sh/majority report6. So there's definitely links on the blog post and YouTube for this one. You're going to get a free premium membership to Skillshare for 2 entire months. Skillshare is an online learning community that offers thousands of classes on almost any topic you can imagine. All classes are taught by experts in their field. They have classes on drawing, painting, photography, video, editing, web design, running a small business, and a whole lot more. Almost all of the classes are less than an hour long, and every class is split up into bite-sized lessons, so it's easy to fit Skillshare into your week, even if you have a busy schedule. I have embarked on and continue my Portuguese, which, pray to God, don't ask me to test out yet, but I will keep going. The system is very easy to use, but I need to be a more diligent student. But it is amazing. It is awesome to have something that you can just take 10 minutes. You know you're not going to get any work done or anything. You're not going to, you don't have the energy to like read a book, but you also don't want to just waste time. So you get in and do something productive. Everyone can benefit from setting aside a little bit more time to get creative. Skillshare has classes at every skill level, whether you want to get better at something you already have a lot of experience with, or you want to explore something that's totally new to you. A membership to Skillshare is less than 10 bucks a month and gives you access to their entire library of classes. But the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majorityreport6, that's the number 6, are going to get a free membership for 2 months. We've put the link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break and we're going to come right back with Daniel Bessner. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Daniel Bessner. He's a Pyle Professor of American Foreign Policy at the University of Washington. He's also author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual, and a new piece that he co-wrote with David Adler in The New Republic called To End Forever War, End the Dollar's Global Dominance. Daniel, how are you? Thanks for being here.
Yeah, good, man. Thanks to be back. Very happy to be here.
So I want to just get a big picture read from you on the election, because I'm sure that that's dominating most people's thought process, but then we will get to this piece. I always keep wanting to remind folks, and it is important, that it's an uphill battle. Obviously everything is kind of stacked against Sanders, and not just as a person, but really as a stand-in for the American working and underclass. And the class tensions are, you know, are extremely clear, and it's terrifying and disgusting, but clarifying, which it should have been clarifying for a long time. But that being said, he won California. The delegate count is close. He's got a huge amount of money. No one has a grassroots army like him, and the game is still absolutely playing. So I say all that this is not a postmortem question. But as a historian, what do you make of? We don't usually go in this lens. We try to, as, you know, more kind of materialist oriented people, to go the class lens. But what do you make of, A, that the young people are not showing up in the numbers they need to show up? And two, just the absolute resounding F you from the boomer generation at young people.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot there. Well, I guess before I get into those specific questions, I just want to say, like, obviously Super Tuesday or Super Thursday, as the case may be, wasn't great for Bernie. And I think that's pretty clear. But I'm actually not particularly worried. I think Biden is an especially weak candidate. I believe that once people actually get their eyes on him and see, you know, the gaffes that he is no doubt destined to repeatedly commit, the fact that he is basically tied to all of the failed policies of the last, you know, four decades of Democratic administrations, the fact that he's kind of an oily guy and not particularly charming, he's kind of like creepy in a way. I actually think if the Bernie campaign hits him in the right ways, that he's not a particularly difficult person to overcome. So although obviously it wasn't great, I also do think that things aren't as dire as people might feel right now. And if anything, it'll actually spur opposition to, you know, it'll actually galvanize people on the Bernie side. And ideally, Warren will also endorse him at some point today or tomorrow. And that'll also bring her supporters over to
incredibly optimistic read here, Daniel. This is like,
well,
this is
no
like creative visualization level. Sorry?
There's no point in not being optimistic until we lose.
So I
don't think it's an impossible path by any stretch of the imagination. Ideally, he would have done better, but he didn't. But I still think we're not in the worst position in the world. But to get to your questions, I do think that'll rely on youth voter turnout. And it's an enormously complex question why people didn't turn out in the ways that they did. I mean, there's obvious structural impediments, like the various voter suppression things going on throughout the country that, you know, that many people have reported on. There's the fact that it takes place, you know, mostly during a workday and people are tired. It's a fact that young voters are particularly alienated from the system. And there's definitely sort of ennui might not be the right word, but a fatalism about the future of the United States. And this is also harmed by the fact that the boomers are just really giving their final FU, as you said, to the millennial and Zoomer generation, which is it's interesting from a historical perspective. It's kind of like the long arc of boomer history is that I was joking on Twitter the other day, you know, it's really kind of funny that the candidates, all of whom are running right now, are really sort of boomers, and they're all born in sort of the halcyon days of the United States Empire in the 1940s. And they're going to be president in sort of the end of the so-called American century, which Henry Luce coined in 1941. And I just think, like, you could just see this as the long arc of boomer history, sort of coming into the most expansive American economy in the United States and then probably even world history. U.S. controls, you know, 50% of world production and leaving it in a state of total disarray. So I just think those votes are votes for a status quo. Sorry, votes for Biden are votes for a status quo and essentially votes for a world that no longer really exists. People are voting. Boomers are voting like it's 1975, 1980, and it's just not any longer. And then there's larger structural impediments to the entire system. You know, there's no real deep left bench, which is why we had to rely on Bernie, who I love, but it's an old, you know, kind of an old guy. And then the next leader is AOC, and she's 50 years younger. So that's, you know, a longer conversation. But I think it has a lot to do with sort of these old ideas failing to die and inertia in both our politics and our political structures.
Yeah, it all makes sense to me, and I learned from you. My pushback, and the only reason I'm doing it is because I do think there is still a little bit of a chance here, and we got to be really smart, you know. And I think, setting aside policy, that the disconnect between what people like you and I, and actually folks who are on the other side of the equation, of a sort of new emergent, you know, and they're us on the left, say other folks maybe more of a kind of new emergent, you know, sort of woke center liberalism or whatever. People who have no do not appreciate Joe Biden on any level and are younger, who are overrepresented in various types of media and academia, I think are like the last people on earth to understand his appeal. And I think you, on a macro level, you've outlined it, is a lot of just, you know, status quo nostalgia, you know, just sort of unthinking entitlement of boomers who have no context of where we are, you know, that we aren't in 1974, you know, we aren't in 1980. But I also do think that this is a guy that actually, you know, if you go out and talk to a lot of quote unquote normal folks, they like him. They find him very likable.
For sure.
And I think that, you know, our sort of various preferences and thoughts and, you know, whether, you know, substantively or not, are, you know, this is actually a great iceberg of, okay, but we, you know, the majority obviously does not sort of share that. So how do we figure out a way of getting back, I think, to some of the sort of just simpler, broader Sanders message going back to 2016 about income and wealth inequality and healthcare and a crisis that Jesse Jackson actually like distilled best in 1988, spanning from, you know, the industrial, you know, sort of white supremacy attacked Reaganism in the 80s, and also, you know, the hollowed rural parts of the country that had, you know, going back to like Bobby Kennedy's poverty tours, right, had never even gotten, I mean, places in the inner and outer that had never even gotten a New Deal or Great Society. And then at the same time, somehow indicating to these overwhelming blocks of voters that I think, in fact, do like Joe Biden, they don't want to reckon with the failures of Barack Obama or Bill Clinton, that somehow you actually say to them, you know, hey, look, yeah, Joe's a great guy, but he's kind of slipping a little bit. You really think he could run against Trump? And, oh, incidentally, we're going to go for some real change here to help people out, but we will give you some sort of sense of normalcy. Like, I think in the last couple of weeks, frankly, that the Sanders campaign has leaned in too much to the, you know, some of the anti-establishmentarian rhetoric. I think that there could have been a pivoting to, we're going to become it because we're actually about to take over the Democratic Party and make it a party of FDR and justice and dignity and so on. Anyway, I mean, how does any of that resonate to you?
I mean, I think that's completely right. And I think that when you're considering about why older people vote for someone like Joe Biden, you have to recognize that for most of them, I mean, particularly white people, especially. But, you know, if you take the long sweep of their lives were like pretty good. Yep. For a lot of them in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Obviously not for people in the deindustrialized West or people who suffered the inequities of neoliberal capitalism, but a lot of Dem primary voters, you know, it was decent for them. So when they're voting for Joe Biden, they're not really, you know, thinking of how a millennial or Zoomer would think, which is our lives have been pretty bad. all things considered on the macro level, and things don't look to get worse. So we're very much in favor of a change candidate, and they're very much not in favor of a change candidate. They want to sort of return to the status quo anti-Trump, which is essentially, and in my opinion, I think it's pretty clear at this point, this sort of embodied ideology of the resistance, right? The resistance is really just a return to like when things were quote unquote good under Barack Obama, and we, you know, sort of that we would be at brunch now, Democratic liberal idea. So I think what you're saying, to me at least, I'm not a political strategist, but to me that makes a lot of sense, which is in some way Sanders has to, you know, transcend the dialectic of, on one hand, presenting himself as a true change candidate, which I believe is critical to the general election, the only way that anyone will possibly be able to beat Trump. On the other hand, at this point in the primary, also presenting himself as sort of returning to, if not a status quo, at least a stability, you know, someone that he could trust. And so I think that will also depend on beginning to release in the next few weeks, you know, plans about who would be in his administration, what types of things that they would be supporting, perhaps even naming a vice presidential candidate that could kind of square that circle. Who that would be, I don't exactly know, but I think you've identified the problem beautifully, which is if Sanders is going to win this primary, he's going to have to take on this sort of resistance ideology in a meaningful way, as opposed to presenting himself as a total tear it down candidate, while in the general election kind of returning to this sort of total tear down at least most of it, or at least call BS on what people are doing candidate. And it's going to be tough, but I also do think, and I do think you're right, that people like Joe Biden, but I think if you really look at him for any amount of time, if there's any significant microscope under him, his weaknesses are so apparent. I can't, maybe I don't want to believe that people could look at him and think that's a candidate who could possibly beat Trump, because he very clearly, at least in my opinion, maybe I'll eat these words, he very clearly has no chance of beating Trump. Trump is more clever. He's funnier.
Right.
He will destroy him on the debate stage. Joe will not be able to respond quickly. He will look out of it. He will look dowdy. And so I think it's kind of interesting to me, and someone should do, a history of this. How is it possible that Joe Biden has emerged as a pragmatic candidate? And a lot of it has to do with sort of backroom party dealing and you know, this sort of ideology that we just talked about. But it, to me, he's very clearly not a pragmatic or realistic candidate.
I agree. I think you're generally right. I think you're in a general election, that's mostly true. And I think if she would accept, I think it would be fantastic if Bernie Sanders would come out with Tammy Baldwin, who's a senator from Wisconsin. And I think that would be, if that move right now was possible, that would be really great. We'll get to I want to get to this piece, but the last question I have for you real quick on this theme, what do you make of the dynamic that if this works, and even if it doesn't work, by the way, like even if we still beat them and push it back, that clearly, and this goes back to, you know, I underestimated the importance of Barack Obama intervening to kill Keith Ellison's chances as head of DNC. I mean, I certainly supported Keith Ellison, but at the time, I'll cop to it. I was shell-shocked. Trump is amassing this, you know, horror show, and, you know, Tom Perez is mediocre, but whatever. But however, that sort of that level of aggression and coordination against any type of even modest reform from the Sanders wing, I think should have been taken as a very clear indication of the sort of fight back that they would get. Now, you know, again, I think there's some things that Sanders' campaign could have done differently and we need to start and can do differently. And we need to start being a bit more, push them maybe a bit more. But that being said, I don't think much, because I think this is still top-down capitalist self-interest of a ruling class and a party that doesn't have any material concerns and opposes universal programs. They're willing to fight more effectively and strategically against Bernie Sanders than Donald Trump, all just to make sure that you don't have health care or a basic standard of living that has been achieved anywhere in the industrialized world. So that is the Democratic Party. People should be very clear about that contrast. And in light of that contrast, what do you make of the historical irony and the dimension of the Republican Party that is driven by white identity politics and racism and xenophobia is very well established and already baked into the cake. But you loop back and you go to, you know, Donald Trump actually slightly increased his margins with people of color over Mitt Romney. You have a, you know, and I'll do the usual disclaimer of a horrible xenophobe and so on, like Tucker Carlson, doing infinitely more segments on his show that have to do with the actual economic conditions of America and the terror and immiseration of working people than you ever see on MSNBC or rarely see on MSNBC. You have a extreme rightist like Josh Hawley, who you know, is a very dangerous figure, you know, speaking very clearly on the danger of Silicon Valley as an example. The Republicans still have the contradiction between being an oligarch party that doesn't want any actual reforms towards redistribution. However, you are seeing a weird juxtaposition where at the highest levels of the Republican Party, along with the base appeals to racism and white identity politics, they are infinitely more real and honest and transparent, you know, about the fact that America's life expectancies are declining, right? Like, I mean, you know, the Democratic establishment has been, you know, it's been like sort of like woke Tom Clancy novels about Russia for 3 years, while these monsters are talking about what's actually happening in the country. What do you make of that sort of realignment of things?
Sure. Well, I think there's a variety of ways to get to sort of the, what Tucker Carlson has been arguing. So one way is sort of the nativist politics that you just mentioned, that essentially they're defining a particular nativist community organized primarily around white people, even though I think recently, like in 2020, you can't just claim that outright, even though I think that's the subtext of someone like Tucker Carlson is doing, you know, demonizing immigrants, incredibly xenophobic and racist, all of those things. And that's one way to get to sort of the welfarist state, right? In some sense, that's what the gamble of the Nazis was, that we're going to give you welfare. It's just going to be organized not around being a human, but by being an Aryan. Right. So this is a long streaming conservative thought that is bubbled and flowed at various times. It sort of went into a bit of hibernation during the Reagan era. But as we're emerging from kind of the world that Reagan created, you see it coming up. And it's a very nativist politics. Another way to get to sort of similar policies is from a social welfareist or social democratic perspective, where instead of saying that you're going to organize it around a particular racial community, which is, I think, the subtext of what people like Carlson are ultimately arguing, is you're just going to organize it around being, you know, usually an American citizen, right? Even though I think you and I would say that has to expand beyond that to include undocumented people living here and people who aren't necessarily citizens.
Of course.
But that's another way to get to the same position, which is sort of a humanistic perspective. The problem, though, is that I think there's an ideology in the leadership of the Democratic Party, which I guess is what I would call a meritocratic ideology. And it's sort of, someone put it on Twitter the other day, feudalism, like the aristocratic ideology was to feudalism what the meritocratic ideology is to capitalism, in the sense that meritocracy justifies the existing socioeconomic structures as somehow just. So you essentially have a professional, in my opinion, you have a professional class of Democratic leaders, many of whom went to, like, quote unquote, Ivy League schools and had good educations or work at McKinsey, work at Goldman Sachs, who fundamentally think that their position in life is justified, and that they also think that they work, you know, many hours for it. They work hundreds of hours, et cetera, et cetera. And so they believe that this world they have is justified, and they've made an alliance with capital, of which they are fundamentally a part, to basically steal the election, or not steal the election. That's not what they've done. That's not accurate. But to basically ensure that someone like Joe Biden wins, who will defend their prerogatives. So I think what you have on both sides is forms of oligarchy. I think the oligarchies are of a different character, but I think that they often arrive at similar political and socioeconomic positions from different lenses. And what Sanders, I think, is trying to do is he's trying to, basically, he'll never frame it this way, but he's trying to essentially destroy the ideology of meritocracy, which is the notion that the people who have the most capital, who have access to the most resources, in some fundamental level, deserve it. And I think this is an apocalyptic political shift. I think that Sanders, the movement, and the fact that so many people under 40 really believe it, have really ended the meritocratic, to use Gramscian terms, meritocracy's hegemony. There's not a system really to replace it. I mean, I think there's some, and you'll agree with this because this is kind of your idea about a cosmopolitan humanism needs to replace it. But I think that that sort of the bubble of meritocracy has been popped and that we need to build something going forward. And even if in the worst case scenario, Bernie doesn't win, I don't think that genie is going to be put back in the bottle for a variety of reasons, climate change, inequality, and the fact that people under 40 didn't grow up in the Cold War, have fundamentally different value systems, don't quite have as much faith in capitalism due to a diversity of historical reasons, most importantly, 2008 and 2009, I think things have fundamentally changed.
Yeah, my last thought on that is real quick, because I do think that the problem is that you have, yes, of course you have the tradition that it comes from on the right is enormously dangerous, and you also just have the raw reality that one side has a leadership and media base that is literally just speaking about actual things across right. these issues. And then on the Democratic side, and sometimes extremely effectively, if we're being honest, and then on the Democratic side, you have, again, yeah, they're not stealing it, but again, you have people who in the face of Republicans or Trump are mostly totally ineffective and embarrassing and kind of scrambling around and, ranting and raving and, calling him Drump or whatever and not accomplishing much. And then, amassing this kind of incredible level of efficacy to destroy the multiracial working class coalition. And then, the other thing that I would just put in a mix just as on a back burner to think about is I think, like, yes, of course, as a moral proposition, it includes as an example undocumented people. And we do need to have a cosmopolitan humanism to sort of be coupled with our socialism. I absolutely believe that. And I also think that there is, a certain subcultural tendency on the left that all of a sudden then becomes this whole other discursive method, which is, we need to demand, we got to get rid of borders. We have to do all of these things that come out of left field, including for, actually quite socially open and left and multiracial working members of a Sanders coalition that really are like very tiny, minute subcultural positions and discourses that then, because media, they have a disproportionate influence. And so then that becomes like, well, what's the relationship between making extreme statements and demanding that folks, conform to various things, some of which are substantively right, some of which are substantively wrong, some of which are just honestly just ways of discoursing that have pretty much nothing to do with anything real. They're just sort of cultural signifiers of certain types of education and reading habits. And the left has never done that. And look, and I'll cop to even people on, look, on TMBS, I'm going to cover, the Cuban Revolution and complexify Castro. It's important. Do I think that, to win, is this exactly the right time to be, using that platform to educate the American public on Fidel Castro? Maybe not. I think we have to be. So it's not totally just like the stuff that I don't, all of the kind of, woke stuff that I really think is a problem. It's even including things, things that I have more substantive sympathy to. It's like, what is the relationship between all of this and actually figuring out, like, you're going up against the Death Star, how do you actually pull this off? But at any rate, go ahead.
I think that's completely right. I mean, I think one thing, and I believe we've talked about this before, certainly in our lives, if not on air, I think that the left has never been particularly good in the United States for being at being strategic. And I think right. what essentially you're saying is that the left needs to be strategic about how it goes about spreading its message, and also recognize the fact that whether we like it or not, I think in 2020 and probably for the foreseeable future, the nation state itself is going to be the engine of socialist transformation. Right. I don't think we're anywhere near a transnational working class revolution. I don't think we're anywhere near a sort of supranational organization, even though if you, in my utopia, these are the things that I want. It's clearly not what's going on today. So I think that you absolutely need to be thinking strategically. And that's the most important thing, particularly in the type of pluralistic political system that we have in the United States, particularly in the fact that we have a presidential system with these two overwhelmingly enormous parties that are essentially not political parties in any meaningful sense. That's a conversation for another time, but are essentially huge agglomerations of interests that are like very difficult to organize politically. So I think you're exactly right. One thing that I would say, two things. First, Fox News is like way better than MSNBC and CNN. At least data shows that you're way more likely to vote Republican. There was a big paper in the American Economic Review from 2 or 3 years ago that analyzed Fox News and MSNBC and CNN. And like Fox News is very good at getting people to vote Republican in a way that MSNBC and CNN are not good at getting people to vote Democrat. And so there needs to be more analysis on that. But one of the major things that I think the right does in a way that far better than not the left, now I'm talking sort of about liberal mainstream media, is that they're able to like identify a real enemy.
Right.
So the right is able to identify enemies, and that they're able to organize their politics around enemies. Obviously, I think it's atrocious, the enemies that they identify, essentially the poorest and weakest members of society, immigrants, refugees, minorities, people of color, what have you. I obviously think it's disgusting, but it's a very good way to sort of organize your politics. The problem is that on the liberal side of the equation, again, not left, but sort of center left centrist, is that they can't identify the enemy because the enemy is capital, and they're totally reliant on capital to basically fund everything that they do. And not only are they reliant on capital, but someone like Rachel Maddow believes in meritocracy. You know, she's the ultimate meritocrat. She's a Rhodes Scholar or something along those lines, right? So not only can she not identify the enemy, but she actually believes in the fundamental justifying ideology of the entire system.
Right. Now, and then it becomes like literally, you know, and set aside whatever you think of this one way or another. But I mean, you know, the idea of Russia as being like the substitute is delusional. Yeah.
Well, this is the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it's classic Cold War playbook, is that you don't look into what's actually going on in your country, which is why did Hillary Clinton lose? Because she was aligned with like the worst capitalist interests. People didn't like her for a diversity of justifiable reasons.
Right.
But you sort of locate this exogenous factor that's external to the United States. It's not a problem with our institutions or our politics or even our candidate. It's sort of this magic thing that comes from outside and sort of changes the entire election. And I'm not denying clearly Russia did something. But if I was going to create a causal list of reasons why Donald Trump won and why Hillary Clinton lost, Russia would probably not even be in the top five, maybe not even in the top 10.
I'm going to say that like Rastas who don't like Hillary on Facebook was not a major factor in the election. I'm just going to put that out there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the reason that they do it, it's to justify their ideology, which is this sort of exceptionalist, meritocratic American capitalist ideology. And how the left challenges that, I mean, I don't know, but that's a generations long project and it'll be really tough.
And also another reason that we really have to keep fighting on this, because like, thank you, Bernie Sanders. I mean, that look,
right.
It's funny to always have to stipulate that you have criticisms of somebody, but it's just a world. This is the only person in the game who would even attempt this. So it requires our appreciation. And I think clearly millions of actual working people do and have, and will keep fighting. In this piece, The End of Forever War, The End of the Dollar's Global Dominance, which we will at least take a few minutes to talk about. you and David Adler start by reminding us of the assassination of General Soleimani several months ago. And just situate how you understand that assassination, especially in light of the discourse of U.S. decline.
Sure. So I think that there's been a lot of discussion about the decline of the American empire and that we're sort of the sick person of the world, et cetera, et cetera. And I just personally think that the discussion of decline is far overblown. I mean, clearly the United States in 2020 is not at the position it was in 1945. Again, I mentioned earlier in this conversation, basically the only world superpower. I mean, people thought the Soviet Union was a superpower. We know it was actually like kind of destroyed and was kind of not really the superpower that people envisioned. So in retrospect, we could see that the United States was the world superpower. And it's clearly not that in 2020. For example, I think the United States will be
being pushed out of East Asia and the next generation probably earlier and things along those lines. But still, what I truly believe is that the United States is by far the world's overwhelming superpower, if not the sole superpower. I'm sure people listen to the statistics, 800 bases, special forces deployed to three-fourths of the world's countries, spends more on defense than the next seven countries to, combined, et cetera, et cetera. What I think that Soleimani assassination demonstrates is that the United States is essentially able to act in the world as it wants with very little consequence. And I think we see that in the fact that we live in this empire and foreign policy has been barely a point of discussion in the debates. The United States is almost unique in world empires in that its citizens, the people who benefit from the empire or don't benefit from the empire, as I would argue, but the people who supposedly benefit from the empire don't even really conceive of themselves as living within an empire. And so the Soleimani, the ability of Trump to basically just do that and to suffer absolutely no consequences as a result demonstrates the sheer overwhelming power of the United States. And it's something that I think we need to take seriously if we're going to, you know, as anti-imperialists or anti-hegemonists, whatever you want to call it, challenge the American empire. But what I also wanted to highlight in this piece, what David Adler and I wanted to highlight in this piece, was the fact that it's not just the military power that I just spoke about that allows the United States to dominate the world. It's also what is termed dollar power, the fact that basically world trade is denominated in dollars, and that regardless of what the United States does around the world, it's very difficult for countries to sort of challenge that because they basically have to conduct their trade in dollars. And if the United States cuts off your access to the Fed, you're essentially going to be unable to do anything in terms of the international political economy. So anti-imperialists, I think, or anti-militarists, however people want to brand themselves, have been really good about calling for things like ending endless war and reducing the United States' global footprint. But the only way that I think a truly sort of global justice is going to ever be able to be realized is if while we're attenuating the United States' military power, we also attenuate the United States' dollar power and pursue a path of monetary multilateralism where no one currency dominates the world until we, of course, get to the utopia of a global currency, and that's sort of Star Trek.
Right. And it reminded me, you get into some very, you know, there's an interesting interpretation of Saddam Hussein. Not in terms of his overall record, but some of the sort of the reason he might have been such a relentless fixation of U.S. empire. I want to bring into this conversation as well in an interview that I didn't get to follow up with him on this theme specifically when I interviewed him. But President Lula gave an interview when he was still, you know, under his unjust and false imprisonment with Brazil 247, where he talked about the BRIC countries and the BRICS, you know, China, South Africa, Brazil, Russia. And people have formulated them as sort of alternative power blocks, the United States, in various ways. Some people with a desire for radical politics, other people who just want a sort of multipolar world, which is important, but doesn't necessarily have a progressive vision attached to it. President Lula said very specifically he wanted the BRICS to be more aggressive and creative. And he specifically said that he wanted them to be a common alternative industry currency. And said, as an example, why if I'm in Bolivia, if I'm Brazilian and I buy, you know, matches, why am I using U.S. dollars? And, you know, he said when that conversation opened, you know, President Obama called him and was like, are you actually trying to do your own currency? That there was a lot of anxiety about that.
It's an enormously important piece of leverage that the United States has over the rest of the world. I mean, it's not just in Latin America, which one might add the United States has been deploying dollar power for like well over a century to control. But it's even in Europe, right? When European countries are buying goods from one another or goods on the global stage, they're doing so in dollars. Recently, I think it was one of the presidents of a high ranking U.S. official, EU official, I forget exactly his position, but he was talking. He's like, why would we buy planes? Are we using American dollars? And the reason that one is doing that is because the empire is essentially asserting its and affirming its economic hegemony. And if people switch to their own currencies, they would have much more freedom of action, not only in the political economy, which, of course, obviously, but also, you know, to deny the United States access to, you know, fly to fly its planes over its country. You know, the United States is able to do things like that because it's constantly able to threaten to cut off people's access to the Fed. And if it's able to threaten that, then countries aren't able to assert true sovereignty. Also, the fact that the United States has the world's currency, we talk about this in the article, it's able to run up enormous deficits that allow it to, you know, purchase all the military equipment and to have this enormously well-funded military. So it's directly connected to military hegemony and military empire. And so going forward, I think the left, as I think it is going to, if it doesn't happen with Bernie, it's going to happen within the next 10 years. The left needs to be really thinking about, if it's serious about an anti-imperialist policy, it needs to be thinking about the connections between dollar power and military power and how one would go about weakening both at the same time in order to bring about what I think a more peaceful and less imperialistic world.
Last question. This actually does loop us back to the beginning. Another perfect example of how Trump's just direct gangster version of it but it still goes back to related, not exactly the same thing, but closely related. The famous line from the 1990s, Thomas Friedman, in one of his, you know, great odes to, you know, corporate hegemonic globalization, which in that time, even though there was actually enormous U.S. military activity across the globe, even in that time, it was actually framed as we're in the era of peace and consumption. And Thomas Friedman, the sort of, you know, the sovereign guru of sort of, you know, just kind of, you know, middle brow bullshit about globalization and, you know, ignoring all of the huge social and environmental costs. He said at one point, I think it was the golden arches of McDonald's are, I think, protected by the planes of McDonnell Douglas, to paraphrase. And so even this idea of Biden and this thirst to return to this previous order, those are two lanes in which there will be full U.S. imperial aggression towards diversifying the global currency supply.
Oh, absolutely. I think just it's important to underline the point you just made is that so-called peaceful globalization was always underwritten by American military power. And I would argue that for the last 75 years, basically the entire structure of the world has been underwritten by military power, and to be even more stark, underwritten by American nuclear power. I think we forget it today because we're so far from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but it really does matter that the United States could obliterate countries basically in the blink of an eye. And I think that it's the ultimate material fact of dollar power, of military hegemony. And I think we're going to have to think about this as a governing left much more seriously in the next 10, 15, 20 years, as sort of the millennial and Zoomer generation begins to move into the actual state and begins to wield the levers of power in a serious and meaningful way.
Daniel Bessner, the piece in The New Republic is To End Forever War, End the Dollar's Global Dominance. He's also author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier, The Rise of the Defense Intellectuals, which is an incredibly well-written book and gives you a institutional history of the military-industrial complex. Also, check out on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube page, we released it for everybody, the illicit history of the RANS Corporation that we did with Daniel Bessner. If you haven't watched that yet, really interesting stuff. Daniel, as always, appreciate your time.
Thanks, Michael. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Be well. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report, majority.fm/become a member. Become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS. There's a ticket link on the majority.fm homepage to our live show in Austin, Texas, April 3rd with Anna Kasparian and Abby Martin. We're excited to see you. We're doing TMBS this Saturday. Actually, we're doing a special Saturday show with Ahmed Cabello, and who's a Sudanese and British journalist. And we're also going to just sort of unravel what's been going on. And then there's a live show coming up in Boston as well. tons of stuff to track. So go get all of it at patreon.com/TMBS and join 113,000 other subs on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. Matt.
Oh, yeah. Not a big plug today. Check out Literary Hangover. I'm going to be doing some streaming soon on the YouTube channel.
Smart. All right, folks. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost has what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ the Anarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
Before today, the globe.
Back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Pussy.